for this morning.
From Frederick Douglass's near-death experience in 1843, we move ahead in time to the early 1920s, when, as our reading just described, the Ku Klux Klan was ascendant throughout the country, nowhere more so than in Indiana. The first wave of the Klan during the post-Civil War period originated in and was largely confined to rural and poor areas of the South, where it terrorized mostly Black men who had just been freed from slavery, courted citizenship, and been enfranchised by the Reconstruction-era amendments to the U.S. Constitution. The Klan's second wave, by contrast, which emerged during the First World War, was prominent in northern and western states and in urban and rural areas alike. It also attracted men and women from the middle classes and presented itself initially as a fraternal order intent upon moral reform, supporting prohibition and proscribing promiscuity. The later Klan retained its enmity toward African Americans, but it added as targets Roman Catholics, Jews, labor activists, suffragettes, and immigrants from outside Western Europe. When its members declared itself for 100% Americanism, it meant white Christian nationalism. They were, in other words, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Indiana was the center of this Klan version 2.0. It was estimated that at its height in the mid-1920s, one quarter of the white Protestant native-born population were dues-paying members, when the $10 fee was equal to a day's wages. In addition to their parades, mass initiations, and cross burnings, the Klan adopted the trappings of other religiously oriented fraternal organizations. They published their own newspaper, The Fiery Cross, attempted to buy a hospital in Kokomo, and a college in Valparaiso, and organized women's auxiliaries and even youth groups nicknamed Kitty Claverns. Our church played a leading role in opposing the Muncie Klan. The Reverend Harry Adams Hersey served as minister of St. John's Universalist Church from 1919 to 1923. Our official history notes that he, quote, denounced the Klan from the pulpit and warned church school children of its dangers. In his written memoirs, Reverend Hersey stated that he and only one other minister in Muncie, a Baptist, came out openly and strongly against the Klan. His outspokenness on that and other issues, however, managed to offend enough people in and out of our congregation and led to his resignation. More typical was the local clergy who wholeheartedly supported the KKK. Singular among their number was one Daisy Douglas Barr, a Muncie-based Quaker minister who was esteemed the Imperial Empress of the Women's Ku Klux Klan, and was an active member of the Women's Christian Temperance Union. Let me say that again. Barr was a Muncie Quaker clergywoman who served as minister to the Friends Memorial Church in Muncie and the First Friends Church of Newcastle. So not all Quakers were on the side of equality of all of God's children. Barr was credited with recruiting some 75,000 women from Indiana and Ohio into the women's KKK. Like Frederick Douglass, a natural and powerful orator, she rose in state Republican political circles and was eventually elected as the Indiana Party's first female vice chair. Barr was reputed to have earned $1 million by selling Klan robes and regalia at $10 a piece that were sewn at her behest by squadrons of her local female supporters, many of whom lived on the south side of Muncie. George Dale's anti-Klan newspaper mocked her with this ditty. Daisy Doodles sued again. Perhaps you think that Daisy's flighty, but she got it all at 10 per nighty. $1 million she got, 'tis said, and gave to the wizard nary a red. So the goblins cussed, and the dragons swore they'd get the dough or buckets of gore. Historian Kathleen M. Blee notes that Barr quickly became a popular national leader in the KKK. She was the only woman invited to address the first annual meeting of the Klan Grand Dragons in 1923 at Asheville, North Carolina. Quote, there Barr read a poem, The Soul of America, which suggested that the Klan represented the very essence of the American nation. Strong, righteous, just, pure, and all-seeing. Barr's fortunes rose and fell with that of D.C. Stevenson, the Grand Dragon of the Indiana KKK. When he was convicted in 1925 of kidnapping, raping, and murdering a young female civil servant from Indianapolis, the Indiana Klan rapidly disintegrated. It had lost its claim to the moral high ground through hypocrisy and mendacity. My final story concerns what has been called the last lynching in the North, which occurred in August 1930 in Marion, just a few short years after the Indiana Klan's precipitous demise. The KKK's disappearance as a formal organization was not accompanied by an improvement in race relations. Three African-American men were arrested and falsely accused of killing a white man and sexually assaulting a white woman. On the sultry night of August 7th, a mob numbering in the low thousands stormed the Grant County Jail and forcibly removed the prisoners, who were savagely beaten before two of them, Thomas Shipp and Abram Smith, were hanged from a tree on the courthouse lawn. The third man, James Cameron, was spared, he believed, by divine intervention, saved for a higher purpose. This heinous crime has a redeeming Muncie connection. Immediately following the lynching, the Reverend John E. Johnson, pastor of the Schaefer Chapel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Muncie, was determined to give the victims a Christian burial. Reverend Johnson, who was also a mortician, traveled to Marion to retrieve the bodies of Shipp and Smith because he knew there were no black undertakers in that community. He was escorted by Delaware County Sheriff Fred Puckett and the Indiana State Police. That night, a few white allies joined with many in the local African American community, to maintain an armed vigil near Johnson's mortuary, with a command post established at Schaefer Chapel to thwart a feared mob reprisal. Fortunately, the attack failed to materialize, and on the following day, Reverend Johnson was again given a police escort to return the bodies to Marion for internment. James Cameron survived to tell his story by becoming a prominent civil rights activist, including an 8-year stint as director of Indiana's Office of Civil Liberties at the state level in the 1940s. He also created America's Black Holocaust Museum in Milwaukee, which he helped run for nearly 20 years until his death in 2006. It was a forerunner of the newer and better known National Memorial for Peace and Justice, created in Montgomery, Alabama, by Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative. That enterprise commemorates the names and places of execution of the more than 4,000 blacks who were lynched in the United States between 1877 and 1950. Stevenson's life story is told in the 2019 docudrama, Just Mercy, based upon his best-selling memoir. For the moral of my three stories, I turn again to the words of Frederick Douglass. They're taken from the conclusion to his last great speech entitled The Lessons of the Hour, which he delivered 1 year before his death in 1895. And I want you to contrast it with the summary that I gave of Daisy Barr's own speech before the Grand Dragons of the Ku Klux Klan National Gathering in 1923, calling for a white Christian nation. In Douglass's words, "Could I be heard by this great nation, I would call to mind the sublime and glorious truths with which, at its birth, it saluted a listening world. Its voice then was as a trumpet of an archangel, summoning hoary forms of oppression and time-honored tyranny to judgment. It announced the advent of a nation based upon human brotherhood and the self-evident truths of liberty and equality. Its mission was the redemption of the world from the bondage of ages. Apply these sublime and glorious truths to the situation now before you. Put away your race prejudice. Banish the idea that one class must rule over another. Recognize the fact that the rights of the humblest citizen are as worthy of protection as are those of the highest, and based upon the eternal principles of truth, justice, and humanity. If you do so, our republic will stand and flourish forever." So now, as we sit in our separate private sanctuaries, take a moment to imagine yourselves congregating in our virtual sanctuary, huddled around a flaming chalice, swapping tales of yore, passing on our people's lore to successor generations. The near fatal beating of Frederick Douglass by pro-slavery advocates at Pendleton, the notorious terrorism of the KKK's second wave in the 1920s, the Marion lynching. What are we to make of those? Regrettably, these notorious incidents are all but absent from our school's history and social studies curricula and remain largely unknown to the populace at large. When it comes to bigotry, hatred, and mass violence justified by religious belief, ignorance is not bliss. The act of remembering these past traumas in situ is the first step toward reconciliation. While we are not responsible for the malign actions of our forebears, we are morally obligated to be accountable for the ways that unacknowledged collective trauma can redound imperceptibly across generations. This week marks the Jewish solemn occasion of Passover, beginning on Wednesday evening, followed by the Christians' observance of Good Friday. Consider both of these holy days are times set aside for the formal remembrance of atrocities inflicted unjustly on one set of people by others with more power. The trauma is recalled, examined, ritually reflected upon, and importantly, reconciled by acceptance and forgiveness. This returns us to our month's theme of liberation, where such ongoing social reconciliation frees us from the trauma's debilitating effect. Group remembrance induces personal reflection, which transforms the afflicted and their descendants from victims into survivors. The story is pulled forward in time and linked to a redeeming outcome. Moses was able, with divine help, to lead his people out of enslavement. The Christian's Messiah was resurrected from a gruesome death by crucifixion. Significantly, it is his death and not the Easter resurrection, which is commemorated as that faith tradition's enduring symbol. Equally important is that institutionalizing the remembrance of acts of mass violence perpetrated in the name of creed, greed, or ethnic nationalism affords the perpetrators and their descendants an opportunity to examine their own conscience, to denounce and repent malevolence. It can thus serve as a check against making it ever socially acceptable to repeat or tolerate these depredations. Pernicious ideologies function like viruses in the body politic. Resiliency can be developed by the vaccine of remembrance and reconciliation. These must be clinically administered in our homes, schools, places of worship, and the other domains of civil society. It is my hope today that this sermon's round of inoculation wasn't too painful, and that as a result, together, we'll all be stronger for its enhancing our herd immunity. Thank you.